Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this session, which is called A Dialogue with Readings. On my far left, we have Helen Garner, who's become well known to New Zealand audiences over the last few years. She has already appeared in this festival. She was born in Geelong, Victoria. I love saying that word, Geelong. I've been trying to learn Maori this year, and I think Aboriginal words would come easier to me. She's an ex-teacher, an ex-journalist, and her first novel, Monkey Grip, was published to critical acclaim 13 years ago, winning the Australian National Book Council Award in 1978. It was subsequently made into a film in 1982. Her other books include Honour and Other People's Children, 1980, The Children's Batch, and Postcards from Surfers, which was printed in 1985 and has since been reprinted twice. Helen has travelled extensively and lived for a time in Japan. She now lives in Sydney and makes her living from various kinds of writing, including the writing of film scripts. Marilyn Duckworth, by some accident of fate, was born in Auckland. But we think of her now as very much a Wellingtonian. She has written 8 novels, including A Gap in the Spectrum, published in her early 20s in London, to wide critical acclaim. This was followed by The Matchbox House, A Barbarous Tongue, Over the Fence is Out, Disorderly Conduct, Married Alive, Rest for the Wicked, Pulling Faces, and A Message from Harpo. She has also published a volume of short stories and a volume of poems. She's won many awards and was our Australia-New Zealand Exchange Fellow in 1989. Both women write from both a feminist and feminine perspective. Both work in the genre sometimes labelled domestic realism. And both, to my mind, have honed their craft to achieve a distillation of subtle irony and oblique wisdom, displaying a light but careful control of their often volatile material. From these writers, we get a perception of what it is to be a thoroughly modern woman living here in Australasia. We also glimpse again, We also glimpse again and again the great price which is paid for present-day female autonomy by women who live out their lives caught between the expectations of the old and the new. Now, what's going to happen is that Helen will read for about 10 minutes, and then we'll have a little bit of conversation. Sorry, Marilyn will read for about 10 minutes, then we'll have a little bit of conversation, and then Helen will read for about 10 minutes, and then we'll have some more conversation, and you will be invited to make questions from the floor.
Thank you. I thought what I'd do is read a very short piece, just a page in fact, from The Matchbox House, which is a novel that came very early in my career. It was published in 1960. And then I'll move on and read a slightly longer piece from Disorderly Conduct, which was published in 1984. It's not in the Unity bookstand, but it will be out again later this year. The reason I'm reading these two pieces is because they both concern a child who is resisting going to school. And one is from my first beginning, and the second one is from my second beginning after my 15-year gap in being published. "My eyes still sore," Glennie mumbled plaintively. "Let's have a look at it." Jean examined it swiftly. "Honestly, I don't know what the fuss is about. You'd better put on your coat and get going." "I've got a tummy ache too," Glennie objected. "Besides, I'll be late now." "Well, hurry then. Here." She broke a bar of chocolate in two. "Take this for playtime." "Thank you," said Glennie, trapped into being grateful. Now she'd have to go. She put on her cardigan slowly, then lifted her coat from the chair as if it were heavy. "You'd better put it on. It's going to rain." "Don't care." But she shrugged herself into it obediently. It didn't start raining until she was halfway across the common. She wasn't hurrying because she didn't want to catch Sue up, Sue's her sister. "I'm an orphan," she was thinking. "My mother's abandoned me. I hope my eye looks awful. I'm going to be late." The rain fell more heavily till she could feel her hair clinging wetly to her head. Her coat flapped open at the bottom, and rain began to soak the hem of her dress. She watched it with morbid satisfaction. Perhaps she'd get pneumonia, catch her death. Why shouldn't she have been allowed to stay home after all, when David stayed home so often? She was getting very wet. She could feel the rain on her collar, and her feet squelched. Some of the dye had come off her shoes and coloured her socks a pinkish brown. There was a dark triangle on her frock where her coat blew open, and now it suddenly occurred to her that the other children might think she'd wet her knickers, might mistake the damp patch. She gave a horrified shudder and tugged the coat across the gap, but it was too late now. Her tears dried at once. Her legs felt clammy. She began to walk faster. The difference between these two, which are probably detectives, that this one I've just read is rather more earnest than the next one, which is has a different tone and it's somewhat more confident. The trouble with reading extracts from, 5 or 10 minutes from actually 9 novels rather than 8 is that you give an audience an idea of that this is representative of what you write, but and it is to a degree, but I do write some slightly different things. So this is the second part. It's from the point of view of the mother rather than the child. And the mother is a single mother with 4 children by 3 different fathers. And I've got the wrong place, excuse me. This is it. Breakfast smells are warring with sleep smells. The kitchen, having spent the night shrouded in unaccustomed silence like a bird under a blanketed cage, now objects to being woken. The tap squeals. The bread knife grates on the formica bench top. The fridge makes sudden gargling coughs and rumbles. Brian completes the violation of silence when he brings his transistor radio to the table. I'll be late home today, Mum. There's a school demonstration against the Springboks, Vanessa says through a mouthful of toast. We're going to Parliament. Oh, good, Sophie says. Good that I'm going to be late, Vanessa asks, suspicious. No, good that you take it so seriously. Sophie has, of course, brought her children up to the view that apartheid is abhorrent. Brian, however, has discovered that his mother can be teased mercilessly on this issue of racism and assumes the opposing view. Stupid blacks, he says. Sophie takes the dishes to the sink. She knows what he's doing and has decided to ignore his needling. Nevertheless, her throat clogs with rage and her vision blurs. How can she live in the house with someone who says such things, even in fun? And this is a child she's pushed from her own womb. She considers his father's genes unkindly. You should come with us, Vanessa says to her brother. You can't really believe black people are inferior. Huh, says Brian. What do you know about it? Oh, stop it, Sophie spits. From the corner of her eye, she catches a triumphant gleam in Brian's. What's Mindy doing anyway? She's been in the bathroom for hours. Mindy, she goes to the door and calls loudly. Mindy's 6, by the way. No answer. Now she's beginning to be concerned. Whoops. She approaches the bathroom door and turns the handle. Locked. She puts her eye to the crack in the panel. Mindy, are you all right? Come along, it's 8:15. I've taken all my clothes off, Mindy pipes, a defiant note in her voice. Are you having a bath? No. What are you doing then? I told you I didn't like that frock. I won't wear it. Oh, Min, it's a perfectly nice frock. Her words sound feeble even to herself. Hasn't her mother mouthed similar words to her at some time or another? What's wrong with it? It sticks to me. Anyway, it's all crushed now. I'm sitting on it. I've taken my clothes off and I'm going to get pneumonia. Unless you let me wear my blue frock. It's in the wash. Then I'll stay home. You won't. You can't make me go to school. I'm not going to open the door, so there. Sophie sighs. That's all right. I don't have an appointment like Daddy did earlier in the week. She's locked herself in her father's car. You can stay there all day if you like. How'll you go to the loo? Mindy shrills, triumphant. Sophie doesn't answer. She hopes frantically that Vanessa and Brian have completed all their bathroom procedures. It's too much to hope for. Vanessa has already arrived in the passageway and is hopping about impatiently. Sophie whispers to her, pulling her back into the kitchen. You'll have to go and do it in the garden, she hisses. We can't let Mindy have her own way. Wipe your bum with your left hand, Brian yells after her. Sophie restrains herself with difficulty from cuffing him. In the garden, Vanessa has piddled on her sock, and a hurried search in the washing basket is necessary to replace it. If you did your folding, Sophie begins, turning over a huge pile of laundry clumsily. I want this all put away in drawers by dinner time. I bet you'll have done it by then, Vanessa guesses. Anyway, I'll be on the march. You want me to go, don't you? Mindy appears in the doorway, dressed apart from her shoes. Her frock is, as she said, badly crushed. Sophie pretends to see nothing strange in her appearance. Come here and I'll do your laces, she offers, and Mindy bounds to her with sudden relieved vigor, holding out her striped sneakers. She cuddles into her mother's lap while the bows are tied in a double knot. Will you take me in the car, she asks Sophie, wheedling. The car's out of petrol. I'll have to coast it downhill to the garage tomorrow. Anyway, you don't need me to take you. You're a big girl now. I'm not. I'm a small girl. You can walk with me then. Sophie is still in her dressing gown and slippers. She plans to return to bed as soon as the children have left. Joe, lucky Joe, has taken the day off work and is sleeping soundly in the back bedroom. Vanessa, how about you walking up with her? You can catch the bus from the other stop. Oh, Mum, you'll make me late. Brian leaps to his feet and grabs his school bag before any demands can be made of him. I'm off, meeting Glenn at the corner. See you, Mum, he bangs out. Sophie and Vanessa watch him go, sharing for a moment a feeling of hatred for the male sex. All right, Vanessa consents. I'll take her some of the way if she's ready. Are you ready, beast? I won't go with you if you don't like me, Mindy begins to weep. Of course I like you, stupid. You're my sister. Oh, come on, give us a hug. Vanessa cuddles the child, who, reassured, goes to Sophie for more cuddles. Silence. Blissful weight of silence, like the fullness of a stomach after a period of starvation. Sophie breathes and sighs, stretching her limbs as if it's these which have been restricted. A niggle of suspicion, born of incredulity at her freedom, sends her to the front window. She needs to be quite sure before she abandons herself to instant coffee, like the middle-class mum in the television ad. The television mum wastes her freedom by playing tennis with another mum. Sophie wouldn't do that. She stands at the window. Without even lifting the light curtain, she can see Mindy sneaking back down the line of the fence, moving quietly, relentless, like a virus creeping up into the bloodstream. In a moment, she will be level with the house. Sophie wants to scream at her own child, her adored Mindy. She turns away, pretending not to have seen. If she doesn't acknowledge this scene, perhaps it will go away. In the same manner, she would ignore approaching migraines as a child until the moment she spewed inconveniently on someone's floor. Mindy has no more intention of vanishing than a migraine. The waiting period goes on for too long. The tension is unbearable. Sophie tightens the sash of her torn dressing gown and launches herself down the steps. All right, you little horror, she calls, then stops. Mindy is talking to a nice lady in a camel hair coat, one of Sophie's more respectable neighbors. The woman is bent over the child solicitously, a hand on her little shoulder. Mindy's face, quivering with waif-like misery, looks pitifully up at her rescuer. Startled by Sophie's outburst, they turn in her direction. Mindy's face hardens imperceptibly. The woman stares at her neighbor's tattered state of undress, sniffs, pats the child sympathetically, and walks on past. Come inside, Sophie calls. Not what she had in mind to suggest at all. Too late. Mindy's up the steps and in the door like a cat. That's it.
Well, I had prepared a lot of erudite questions, and when I was with these ladies outside, they said, let's talk about sex. So let's talk about sex. I know that Marilyn's mother, Irene Adcock, is in the audience, and I often wonder when writing about sex, how do you cope with writing about it, and how do your families cope with it? Marilyn?
Well, they cope very well. I think that one of the things in this book, this wasn't actually what I was going to talk about, but it's irresistible, that the mother in the book, being a single mother looking after children, has a lot of difficulty in being a sexual person as well as a mother. I think that's quite an important thing. But what I'd really like to do is talk about how things were when I began to write, when I had my first beginning, and how different things were when I moved on and began again in 1984. And you might have picked up that in the second part that I read, I was referring to the Springbok Tour protest movement. But when I began to write, I was totally non-political in my outlook, and I didn't even know I was a feminist. You know, I knew I was a woman. I was very aware that I was a woman, and I thought this was it was very important to write as a woman. I felt that there were too many women who were leaving things out and who were sort of they were romanticizing the role of women and at the same time diminishing it, and I wanted to be honest. Of course, one always wants to be honest. And But I was, when I was writing, I was writing and modelling myself on male writers, Graham Greene, for instance, Joyce Carey, Robert Graves. These were my heroes. And so I was wanting to write as a woman, but I was modelling myself on men. But I was writing, as Rosemary has said, in the feminist perspective. I discovered later, in fact, this was brought home to me vividly last year when I was asked to talk to some students about feminism in my novels. And they discovered that there was only one novel, two of my novels had just gone out of print, there was only one novel they could use that was in print, and it was this The Matchbox House, the one I read from first. And I thought, feminism in the Matchbox House? I agreed to do it. They were going to pay me. But, you know, I was quite sceptical about it. And then I went home and I reread it, and I thought, goodness. And we talked about it, students and I, and we discovered I'd written this tremendously feminist novel. So it was quite a revelation to me.
Well, it's this sort of message versus social commentary business in your book, Message from Harpo. I think the point of the book was it was based on a telegram from Harpo Marx that said, "No message, love Harpo." So I think what Marilyn was saying, that there was no message. Do you feel an outside pressure to deliver a message to the world?
I think people do look for messages. But do you have this problem? Because I find that if you can't write thinking you are going to deliver a message. Mm. To me, this is death to any kind of real life within the novel.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I never was writing with a message either, but that's the last thing I'd think about now. But I think that when my third book came out, some people in Australia, women who'd... let's start in a different point. I don't want to think of myself as a feminist writer because I think feminism is... It's been very useful to me, and at certain points it's actually saved my personal life from complete collapse, and it's also given me a place to stand at certain points to make sense of my experience. But it's not of any use to me, or any sort of doctrinaire feminism is of no use to me as a writer. In fact, rather the opposite. When I first started to publish, which was much later than you, it wasn't until 77, I was... picked up by, you know, I was sort of hailed as a woman writer, and that was the main thing that I was. I still find that slightly mortifying. I mean, now I find it mortifying if people describe me in such a way, as if there are two categories, there are writers and women writers, and I find that very mortifying. But when my third book was called The Children's, by the way, it's Bach. It's the composer, not Batch. I didn't know what a batch was until my third book's called The Children's Bach, which is named after the composer, and J.S. Bach, and it's also named after a book of so-called easy pieces for beginners learning the piano. But when I first came to New Zealand, somebody said Batch, and I thought, surely that isn't how they pronounce that name over here. And then I realised that Batch was a thing. I mean, I think I know what it is. But... yeah, that's caused me a few problems. But when that book came out, people, some feminists were quite snibby about it and thought that because the woman character in it actually returns to her family after an escapade, they found this some kind of backsliding on my part. So I realised at that point that I'd parted company with at least that section of the women's movement. But... message is the last thing I'm interested in.
Well, Helen, I thought with your later writing, especially in Postcards from Surfers, that the message had become quite cryptic. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't really know what you mean by message.
You know, that there perhaps wasn't a message per se, but that there was an underlying theme in those stories. And, you know, it seemed to be about the difficulty of being a feminist in a modern world.
Mm. Oh, well, I certainly didn't mean them to be about that. That, I mean, I didn't consciously mean it that way. Perhaps that's if you read the story from that angle, maybe you could see that in them. Margaret Mahey used an expression the other day. She said, talking about a character, the prodigal son, I suppose, she said, so-and-so quarrelled with his father and left home without a blessing. Mm. And when she said that, I realised this is a description of me. I think that a lot of things I write are about people who've left their family without a blessing. And that's something I'm interested in writing about and working out. But there's no message. Don't look for a message.
One of the pressures that I've felt is the pressure to be a New Zealand writer, which doesn't bother me as much now because I feel I am becoming one. And you only feel pressures if you can't do what's being asked of you. But I do feel that it's something that we do have in this country is this feeling, and I think you have in Australia too, the pressure to be Australian. You are very Australian.
No, I'm not doing it on purpose.
Has that ever been a problem?
Not really. No, I don't think so.
In a perception overseas, I mean.
That goes without saying.
That's a difficult one.
That's rather galling at times too, but there's nothing I can do about that.
Quite, yes.
That, I'm afraid.
Well, perhaps now we could ask Helen to read for us.
Okay. I'm going to read the shortest possible story out of this book, Postcards from Surfers. That was my most recent book, which is on that table over there. This story is called The Dark, the Light. And it's quite short. It's about gossip, really, but it's also about two different towns. And I suppose any Australian who read this story would know it was about Melbourne and Sydney, but it could work just as well about any country that had two cities, one of which was bigger and more capital-like than the other, even if it wasn't, strictly speaking, politically the capital. But that's what it's about, and it's about envy and spite and sadness about other people getting married. The Dark, the Light. We heard he was back. We heard he was staying in a swanky hotel. We heard she was American. We washed our hair. We wore what we thought was appropriate. We waited for him to declare himself. We waited for him to call. No calls came. We discussed his probable whereabouts, the meaning of his silence, the possibilities of his future. We thought we saw him getting into a taxi outside the Rialto, outside the Windsor, outside the Regent, outside the Wentworth, outside the Stock Exchange, outside the Diorama. Was it him? What was he wearing? What did he have on? A tweed jacket, black shoes, even in summer? His idea of this town is cold. He's been away. He's lost the feel of it. He's been in Europe. He's been in America. He's been in the tropics. He's left. He's gone. He doesn't live here anymore. He's only visiting. He's only passing through. Was his face white? His shirt was white. His hair was longer. Did you see her? She wasn't there. He was on his own. We saw them in a club. We saw her. She was blonde. They were both blonde. They were together. They were dressed in white, in cream, in gold, in thousands of dollars worth of linen and leather. They sat at a table with their backs to the wall. The wall was dark. They were light. Their hair and their garments shone. They knew things we did not know. They owned things we had never heard of. They were from somewhere else. They were not from here. They were from further north, from the sunny place, the blue and yellow place, the sparkling place, the water place. They were from the capital. More than one of us had to be led away weeping. He's gone. He won't live here again. He's left us behind. He's gone away and left us in the cold. The music stopped, and they got up and left, and the door closed. We stood in our dark club, in our dark clothes. Invitations came, but not many. Hardly any, very few. Did you get one? Neither did I. Maybe the mail, a strike, a bottleneck at the exchange? There were very few, only three or four. Will you go? Of course not. It wouldn't be right. It would hurt. It would be wrong. I couldn't do it. I wouldn't be able to live with myself. I'd lose friends. I wouldn't be seen dead. If you don't, I won't either. It's a moral issue. I couldn't possibly. What happened up there? Did you go? Did you hear? What was it like? Tell us what happened. It was summer. He was early. She was late. She made an entrance. The bells were ringing. The organ thundered. His hair lay in stiff, sculpted curls. She was all in cream. Her hair was up. She was choked with pearls. His family was there. The church was packed. He gave her his arm. They stood sides touching. The minister threw back his head and shouted, "Come into their hearts, Lord Jesus." The guests were embarrassed. They fluffed their bobs. They brushed their shoulders. They read the brass plaques. It was religious. It was low church. It was not what we thought. We imagined something else. It was not his style. It was a bit much. It was over the top. It was a church after all, and what did you expect? The guests were clever. They knew better. They were modern. They sat in the pews and sneered. And afterwards, outside, The trees were covered in leaves and threaded with coloured lights. It was night in the garden. The air was warm. The night was tender. French, at least, we thought. We thought French. We held out our glasses. The waiters twirled among us. The bottles were napkined. It was local. We had hoped for better. We drank it anyway. We became more grateful. The family stood in line. They shook our hands. They welcomed us. We were ashamed of our ingratitude. We saw him standing alone for a moment under a tree. We stepped quickly towards him to show him we had come. We had come a very long way. We had come to show him we had come, to deliver the compliments, to bring the greetings of the other place. We stepped up, we reached out, our fingers touched his elbow, and she came swooping, all creamy with pearls. He spun on one heel, his hands opened, he showed us his palms, he smiled, he melted. He was no longer there, he was gone. The trees were covered in leaves, their branches were threaded with coloured lights. Our clothes were stiff, our clothes were dark. Our clothes came from the other place, and we too came from the other place. We put down our glasses, we turned away, we turned to go back to the other place, we turned and went back to the other place. We went without bitterness. Humbly, we went away.
In one of the short stories in that book, I think it was The Life of Art, you quote Henry James saying something to the effect that if one throws oneself on the alternative life, which is the life of art, it never fails one, and in fact sees one through everything. Do you still believe this?
Well, of course, in that story, it wasn't me talking, it was the character.
I understand
who,
that.
Yeah,
yes.
But I just want to make that distinction that that story called The Life of Art, which somebody, by the way, accused me of having a very pompous title, but it was the point of the story, so I thought it was okay. It's about two women talking to each other. This is in Postcards from Surfers, this story. It's about two women talking to each other, and one's a painter, and it's a very broken-up story. It's got little slabs and slivers of their lives intercut with each other. And I'll just see if I can find it. There's a rather sad bit at the end that everybody always mentions, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I went into my friend's room. Oh, the friend is a painter, and she's anxious about her future as a painter. I went into my friend's room while she was out. On the wall was stuck a sheet of paper on which she had written, "Henry James to a friend in trouble. Throw yourself on the alternative life," which is what I mean by the life of art, and which religiously invoked and handsomely understood, je vous le garantis, never fails the sincere invoker, sees him through everything, and reveals to him the secrets of and for doing so. I'll read the next bit, it's only another page. Is that okay?
Yeah, good.
I was sick. My friend served me pretty snacks at sensitive intervals. I sat up on my pillows and strummed softly the five chords I had learnt on my ukulele. My friend sat on the edge of a chair with her bony hands folded round a cup and talked. She uttered great streams of words. Her gaze skimmed my shoulder and vanished into the clouds outside the window. She was like a machine made to talk on and on forever. She talked about how much money she would have to spend on paint and stretchers, about the lightness, the optimism, the femaleness of her work, about what she was going to paint next, about how much tougher and more violent her pictures would have to be in order to attract proper attention from critics, about what the men in her field were doing now, about how she must find this out before she began her next lot of pictures. "Listen," I said, "you don't have to think about any of that. Your work is terrific." "My work is terrific," said my friend on a high note, "but I'm not." Her mouth fell down her chin and opened. She began to sob. "I'm 40, said my friend, "and I've got no money." I played the chords G, A, and C. "I'm lonely," said my friend. Tears were running down her cheeks. Her mouth was too low in her face. "I want a man." "You can have one," I said. "I don't want just any man," said my friend, "and I don't want a boy. I want a man who's not going to think my ideas are crazy. I want a man who'll see the part of me that no one ever sees. I want a man who'll look after me and love me. I want a grown-up." I thought, if I could play better, I could turn what she has just said into a song. "Women like us," I said to my friend, "don't have men like that. Why should you expect to find a man like that?" "Why shouldn't I?" said my friend. because men won't do those things for women like us. We've done something to ourselves so that men won't do it. Well, there are men who will, but we despise them. My friend stopped crying. I played the ukulele. My friend drank from the cup. Now, a lot of people got very upset by that story, including me, because that was one of those stories that I didn't know where it was going when I began. It's strange to read the last bit because there's a lot of quite funny and optimistic and quite tender things that happen in these women's lives, but